begin 2017. Hey, Happy New Year's to you. Hope your holiday was a good one. You enjoyed yourself. You had some time off, I hope. You just kind of kick back. And we are into the new year. I'm looking forward to it. I hope you are too. Earth Ancients is brought to you by Gaia. Gaia is offering their special 99-cent launch special. And I keep telling everyone, 7,000 titles. This is bulk of this material on this streaming media site is Earth Ancients related. Ancient culture, ancient traditions, ancient body work, yoga, meditation, things like that. And there's tons of new series out there. And I mentioned on the last program, this Greg Braden new series that will be coming out this week. Actually, if you sign up now, they launched it a couple days ago. And it's Missing Links. And it's I'm not going to give it away and talk too much about it. I want you to check it out. So go to Earth Ancients. So go to Gaia, www.gaia.com/Earth Ancients and sign up. That's the Earth Ancients page. You'll sign up for 99 cents. And for 1 month, you can check that out. After that, it's a nine buck a month charge. But every single month, they add a whole new series. And I think you're going to like it. We've had Greg on the program before. He sent me a nice intro last week. Missing Links is a new series, one of 7,000 amazing titles. So check it out. Gaia.com/Earth Ancients. I want to remind you to sign up for the Earth Ancients page so you get the regular material. Go to Earth Ancients with an S. .com and register. Scroll all the way down to the bottom and register so you get updates, you get all the information, and you're on top of what's going on. It's important that you get this stuff because other than going onto the Facebook page, which is has limited space and it's set to their categories, Earth Ancients website allows you to get on the newsletter that comes out every month, and I'm sending out free stuff. Plus, you can read about what's going on and listen to past shows. So, earthancients.com. So sign up for that. I hope you will.
Coming to you live from around the world, it's Earth Ancient News.
And this is kind of cool. This is something I just discovered actually the last week of December, and it's in archaeological news. Apparently, scientists were looking at a stencil that was made about 40,000 years ago in Sulawesi, Indonesia. And what they've decided, they were actually curious if it was a male or female that made these amazing stencil handprints. And you've seen them. Hand was placed on a wall. Pigment was sprayed around the hand, and it leaves this hand impression. And they were curious if it was male or female. Well, they've discovered and they've actually developed a new technique that's about 90% accurate that can indicate it was a man or a woman who made these types of wall stencils. And the program now is so accurate, they're using it around the world. They just started using it a few months ago. And it's kind of something they want to date. They want to be able to date the male or female hand. And I guess what the system does is it scans the actual surface, and based on the length of the fingers and the size of the palm, they can determine if it's a male or a female. So that's kind of cool. And I'm going to go ahead and post this article. It's in Popular Archaeology. It'll be on the Facebook page, Facebook Earth Ancients. go to the group and you'll see it. Title of the article is Who Made the Ancient Rock Art 40,000 Years Ago? And this one is in Indonesia. It's going to be interesting because there's a tremendous amount of these stencil designs in Arizona, in various kivas in New Mexico, and around the world. And let's think about that. If it's a male or a female, it might make us think twice about who is, you know, maybe dominant or who is the artistic types, so on and so forth. So anyhow, check it out on Facebook page. I think you'll find that article interesting. Okay, so here is our program today. It's with Laird Scranton. We've had him on before. This is a brand new discovery. It's a Stonehenge-like facility found in Scotland, and what they have discovered is mind-blowing. So I hope you'll enjoy this. I'll come back at the end, and we'll talk about the next program. In the last couple of months, I've been reading about this amazing place called Scarabray. It's in northern Scotland, and I first became aware of it in an article that I found in National Geographic, and they talked about and actually showed some very interesting photographs. They called it Before Stonehenge. And it's quite old. It's dated at 3,200 BC, over 5,000 years old. But there's a lot of very unique aspects to this site. Wanted to discuss today, and we have on with us Laird Scranton, and we've had Laird on before a couple of times, I believe. And for those of you who don't know Laird, he's a he's quite a prolific author. He's written books on ancient cosmology and language, including the science of the Dogon, point of origin. And we had him on for China's his book, China's Cosmological Prehistory, which was quite interesting. And he's coming to us today from Albany, New York. Laird, how are you today?
I'm good, Cliff. How are you doing today?
I'm good. Hey, thanks for taking some time out to talk to us a little bit about this this fascinating book. I want to preface this the book that you've written with a little bit about your study and the study of comparative cosmology. Can you tell us a little bit about what that is? I want you to tell our audience your perspective in looking at these sites, and specifically the Scarabray location, this Neolithic Scottish site.
Yeah, well, what I try to do is to learn more about symbols and myths and rituals of various cultures by comparing how different cultures who have the same practices understand their own practices. And so the process for me began in northern Africa with a modern African tribe called the Dogon, who have a lot of things in common with Judaism and ancient Egypt and Buddhism. And right. Then it sort of moved from there to Egypt, to India, to Tibet and China, then down into Turkey, and then now this latest book is about northern Scotland, which was an area that I really had not intended to write about yet.
Mm-hmm.
What's of interest that in northern Scotland here is this, what's interpreted as the first farming village in Neolithic times around 3200 BC. This is
right.
A couple of hundred years before dynastic Egypt, so it's pretty old. And the problem is that this site, which consists of eight chambered houses, they're interpreting them as, has been excavated under excavation and looked at carefully since the middle of the 1800s, and there aren't any really coherent theories about who the people were or where they came from or why they were there, why they decided at that moment to switch from family farms to farming villages. And I had been asked by a distant friend by email if I thought there could be Egyptian influences here. I thought, well, I don't know that much about northern Scotland, but I do know that the African tribe, the Dogon, seem to have been Egyptian in about that same era, around 3,000, 3,200 BC. It looks like they were Egyptians. And they've done a really good job of preserving their practices. And I thought I might be able to find some comparisons to be made between Scarabray and the Dogon culture.
Okay.
So I took that approach. There's not a in Egypt, we're used to seeing, you know, just a wealth of evidence. There's every kind of temple and painting and carved figure and inscribed hieroglyph and whatever. I mean, there's a wealth of evidence to look at in Egypt to try to base opinions on. At Scarabray, that's not true. There's a very small amount of evidence. They're looking at some pottery. They're looking at, there is an ancient language called the Faroese language. There's architecture that is drywall stone architecture. It's flat stones that were laid without mortar to build basically rounded chambers that people were living in. It looks like it was 8 houses and room for maybe 20 families at a time. And it's understood that these people were farmers. They were capable fishermen also, but they were primarily farming and raising domesticated animals. And
okay.
The pottery doesn't connect to anything Scandinavian. The language doesn't really connect originally to anything Scandinavian. The architectural forms have some unique features. The original houses there had a round room at one end that researchers there call unique. They refer to it as a beehive cell-shaped room. And so there wasn't a lot to begin to work with. So I started with an overview of the village and just asked myself generally, is this comparable to what a Dogon village would look like? And in fact, it is. It's laid out in a similar way with passageways, internal passageways between buildings that people could walk in. There's nothing about it that would automatically argue that it couldn't be out of the same culture. There's also a particular building there that struck me because both the Scarabray site and the average Dogon village are considered to be very peaceful places. And one of the ways that peace is maintained is with what's called the discussion house. It's a sort of a rounded building that the rule in the village is if there's a dispute between people, they have to go to that discussion house and they can't leave until they've resolved it. So it looked to me like Scarabray had one of those houses. That's a potential tie into the same cultural mindset.
Okay. So let me just ask you this. Let me just, before you go anywhere, I want because you're talking about some areas that we're going to cover, and it's a unique place for many reasons, but I want you to help us understand the importance of Scarabray as it in a reflection to not only the Dogon, but also the Egyptians. Why it's a unique place? Because when I read this article, not only are these megaliths close by, and they are great for use in calendars and for other contemporary things that during that time, similar to Stonehenge. But what did you find were the real keys to make this place unique? Just to start off, give us an overview.
It's unique in the region because it was the first farming village, but at the same time that these are looked at as being simple farmers, they were also building these megalithic sites, which are the first megalithic sites in the United Kingdom, even precede traditional dating of things like the pyramids in Egypt. But like the Egyptian pyramids, which were built to a cross-generational plan, these sites were also built to a cross-generational plan. They were built over a period of 600 years. And so one generation finished up what the previous one started. We have a series of these large stone, you know, multi-ton stone stones to create sites that were connected by a road back in Neolithic times that led to the Scarabray village. So we know that they were conceptually related to each other because of that. But the trick was for somebody like me, how do you anchor any opinion about what this represented? This is before written language appeared even in Egypt, and very, very little evidence to work from. So the key that I ended up finding to make a link, an initial link, was the original form of the houses at the farming village. Now, those houses happen to take the same shape as a typical Dogon stone house, although the Dogon normally don't build stone houses. When they do, they build them to a particular plan. And that plan has meaning for the Dogon. There's cosmological meaning. There's symbolism associated with the shapes of the house. The house represents the body of a sleeping woman or a sleeping goddess. Anybody who's familiar with ancient Egypt might know my friend John Anthony West wrote a lot about Shuala de Lubet's Temple of Man at Luxor, which Shuala came up with a radical theory that this architecture was laid out to represent a human body.
Yes.
The same is true with this Dogon house. It was there to represent a body. The round room is the head. There are two side rooms that represent arms. A central room that represents a body cavity. At Scarab Ray, there's a hearth in the center that represents a heart. And there's an entryway that represents the sexual parts. And so by finding this match in the architecture and knowing that there's cosmology associated with the Dogon architecture, now suddenly it was fair game for me to start interpreting things at Scarab Ray in terms of that Dogon cosmology and in terms of Dogon and an Egyptian language. And once you start doing that, then all sorts of things pop up for us. Place names that don't make any sense. They don't have any roots in the Scandinavian languages. Suddenly you can explain right away, looking at a Dogon word or an Egyptian word, why this place was called what it was called, or why this structure was situated at this particular site based on things that are nearby. And we have a series of sites that extend along this road, and they represent a sequence of shapes. And those shapes don't really have a whole lot of meaning for the people who are researching it in northern Scotland. But for me, I could see that the sequence was a familiar sequence. These are, they represent progressive stages of how matter forms in the Dogon tradition. And so I then tried to use language and other evidence to support the idea that we had a progression here that led to the village. The village itself was also symbolic, according to that mindset. You have progressive stages that lead to the village, and the village represents a fundamental structure of matter that scientists refer to as a Calabi-Yau space. This is a cluster of dimensions that exist at every point in space-time, according to string theory.
Okay, interesting. I was referring to the National Geographic article. I don't think they found any grave sites to reference, did they, when they were excavating
Not very many. That led them to have to conclude that maybe the people there cremated somebody who died and buried them in mass burials, so they didn't come across individual burials associated with this. It's interesting that when you go to ancient Egypt, the earliest burial chambers represented houses. And in the book, one of the things I mention is a first dynasty burial that's been excavated in Egypt that's built to the same plan as the main Dogon house.
Exactly.
So,
yeah.
No, but you're right. They haven't found any. They're confused because they haven't really found remains of bodies at Scarab Ray. So they don't know what's going on there. They also haven't found any evidence of weapons or of fortifications of any kind, so they know it was a peaceful place.
There's also, and I find this quite fascinating, the site was built 3,200 B.C., then after 600 years, it was covered over. And there's a lot of reference to Göbekli Tepe when they look at this, because Göbekli Tepe had the same situation. It was used, they think, as some kind of a learning center, and then suddenly covered up. Is it your feeling that this location may have been a school of some kind, or because these standing monoliths are astronomical, calculators, calendars, if you want to call them that.
Right.
It could have been a learning center of some kind. And those housings could be temporary. And, of course, the people like Graham Hancock believe that Göbekli Tepe was a center for the survivors of a great deluge who came and re-educated the people. What do you say? What do you say about the Scarabre?
The structures say to me that it absolutely had to have been an instructional center. If you may remember, there had been a touring exhibit that went around to the museums back in the 1990s where the exhibits in this in the museum were represented the organs of the human body, and it was on a large enough scale that children and adults could just walk right through. You could walk from, you know, the flow from the heart to the lungs and so forth. Experience the body, you know, at human scale. Well, that's what you have here. You have sequential stages of how matter forms on a scale that you can walk through. And that says enormous things. First of all, that anybody would know to put that particular sequence of shapes together. Second of all, to build them on such a large scale and have them be that accessible, I can't imagine any purpose for that other than instruction. But the site was lived in for around 600 years and then abandoned abruptly. There is an open question in Göbekli Tepe as to why it was covered over, and there are various opinions as to why that might have been. Same thing here. We actually have, if we can imagine it as a relationship between this later site and the earlier one, we have more evidence here about why it was covered over. One of the viewpoints on Göbekli Tepe was that at that time there were, at 10,000 BC, there were solar flares that were capable of inflicting damage on the earth, and one of the theories is it was covered over to protect the site.
Right.
But in the 3200 BC era, we don't have that same environmental consideration, so that preserving the site from outward destruction doesn't seem like it was a motive. But the people who lived there had enough warning that they were leaving that they held a final feast and they left us some symbolic statements as to why they were leaving. This final feast, they slaughtered, I think, 400 animals, at least 400 animals for this feast. One can imagine that if they knew they were planning to leave the island, that they didn't want to leave farm animals behind that were going to starve. And so they had this grand feast, and when they were done, they placed bones, all carefully placed bones all around the side of the feast before they covered it over. But not just any bone, they only left thigh bones, tibias. Now, the way the Egyptian hieroglyphic language works, the word for tibia is pronounced the same way as a word that means to depart under duress, to depart urgently. And so we can tell both from the feast and from the bones that were left that something was going on that required them to leave there suddenly. Not so suddenly that they didn't have time to plan what they were going to do with their animals, but obviously they were trying to get out of there fairly quickly. Hmm. Now then, covering over the rest of the site, they left a couple of other things. They left a carcass of a deer over the top of the site, which also indicates departure. And they left the head of a bull on top of that. An Egyptian word for the head of a bull, the skull of a bull, is comes from the same root as the goddess named Seshat, who was the goddess who took ascendance in the Egyptian temples once dynastic Egypt was founded around that same period of time. Hmm. Now, there's the sequence of structures on Orkney Island, where Scarabre is, and at Göbekli Tepe have, there's a term that refers to them in these ancient cosmologies. The word is ark. It might be spelled A-R-Q or A-R-K as it gets transliterated in various cultures. But that word ark can also mean to cover over or to bury. And when you look at the Egyptian glyphs of the word, what the glyphs do is they depict the sequence of events that happen every day in a Jewish temple all over the world. When they finish reading a Torah scroll, they roll the scroll up, cover it over very carefully, tie it with a band, and then put it back into a cabinet called an Aron HaKodesh, and that Aron HaKodesh gets abbreviated to Ark. So we have this set of meanings that all relate to the word ark that make it look as if the act of covering over a site when they were finished using it had the same symbolism to them as the act of carefully covering over a Torah scroll after you're done reading it.
Fascinating. You compare the Dogon construction quite eloquently with this the construction at Scarabray, and you actually have photographs of both of these locations. Did you find that the construction was very close in terms of rocks and things like that to the Dogon, or was it more that they used the general floor plan, which is actually quite sacred?
Right, it's so sacred. I think it's the physical layout of Malta is made to, was originally made to that same plan. This is the idea of a sleeping goddess is one that really rests at the foundations of a lot of these creation traditions. The non-material is considered to be a sleeping goddess, and the process of creation is her, the act of her waking up and perceiving things.
Okay.
So this is a fundamental idea that is at the bottom of the cosmology that this whole thing relates to. So it makes sense that we find that there. The construction type we're using, in both cases, structures are built, when possible, from the same flat type of stone. I think in, on Orkney Island, it's limestone that fragments into even pieces that can be stacked very nicely. The Dogon, when possible, do that. But the Dogon live in the desert, which means they can build a mud house, and the mud will hold its form, and they don't always have to build from stone. They don't have as much access to... I think it's actually easier for them to build from mud than it is from stone. But when they do build a stone house, it's to that same plan. Now, my original outlook coming into this was that I was seeing Egyptian and Dogon influences on northern Scotland. And I approached the research and the study from that perspective, even though I knew that the era is a couple of hundred years too soon for anybody to really think that ancient Egypt could have pulled together an expedition to go there. You don't even have the structures of kingship in place in Egypt yet. It would be hard to find an academic who would say, oh, yeah, at that point they could have mounted an expedition to go do this clear across Europe from where they are. But as I got into the research, I realized that there were pieces that didn't fit. And one of the key pieces was the question of this hearth that's in the center of the house in the Scarabray houses. The Dogon don't have that hearth in the center of their house. And I thought, well, there's a difference in climate. It's warmer in Mali than it is in northern Scotland. So when they implemented that house plan in northern Scotland, I thought it was really interesting that they decided to add the hearth in keeping with the symbolism of the house. They put it right where it should be, and it represents a heart. It wasn't until about a third of the way through my process that it occurred to me that I might have this backwards, that the influence I was seeing, the Scarabray house was the original version of it, and that the Dogon, when they moved to Africa, removed the hearth because they didn't need it in the house. They moved it out into a courtyard. They'd still build the same type of hearth, constructed the same way, but it's no longer in the house. It's out in the middle of the courtyard.
Fascinating.
So I started to get a sense that what we were seeing here were pre-dynastic influences. There is no accepted theory right now as to where the pharaohs came from. They were, whoever they were very capable and sort of arrived immediately able to take charge of things in Egypt and establish kingship and unite the two halves of the country and do all sorts of interesting things. Well, the Scarabray site looks like it could potentially have been a place where education happened that made that happen. We know they were conducting agriculture on Orkney Island. The tradition that I've been pursuing is a melding of mythology and civic skills. They were teaching a civilizing plan that were all the prerequisites for an agriculture, but tagged to, sort of mnemonically tagged to concepts of creation. So the way that you plowed a field reinforced teaching about how a process of matter happened, or the way you wove your cloth reinforced a process of how matter forms. And these were integrated teachings.
Mm-hmm.
So There's also an open question for me. Back in the Göbekli Tepe days, what we find typically are sanctuaries that are built high on mountaintops. And one of my perspective of one of the reasons why that might be is that being up high afforded some protection for the teachers from us. It was harder for us to get up there and interfere with them if they were high up. You go to Orkney Island, and that's not true. You have an island that's right out in the middle of everything. You've got Atlantic Ocean currents that would lead a boat directly to it. And you've got easy harbors where it's easy to land a boat. There's not very much change in elevation on the island. It's very accessible, easy, and indications are at the time it had a very comfortable climate. So my question was, if there were teachers here, what are they doing to protect themselves? Where is their safe haven? If things get dangerous, where are they going to go to protect themselves? Well, the easy answer is that just across the water to the west and north of Orkney Island is a group of islands called the Faroe Islands. Now, my first reaction to that is to say, Faroe, F-A-R-O-E, and Faroe, P-H-A-R-O-H.
Yeah.
It seems a little too precious that those two words sound alike.
You know, that's funny that you would mention that. That is something I never thought about. The Great Pharaohs. Yeah, really.
Okay, so, but then I'd look at it from another point of view and say, back in those days, any resemblance between two words in Egypt or for the Dogon automatically implied a relationship between words. So it would sort of be remiss not to explore, could there be a connection between the two? Now, you were talking about Atlantis. Well, one of the ancient languages that I'm using to interpret things in northern Scotland is called the Faroese language. Now, in the Faroese language, the words Atlantis mean ancestral country or ancestral homeland.
Right.
The word pharaoh in Egypt was originally expressed as Per-A, P-E-R-A-A. Those words in the Egyptian hieroglyphic language can mean ancestral country. So you have a coincidence of meaning there between the word pharaoh and the word Atlantis. You have all sorts of interesting things in the Faroe Islands, natural protections that would, you have islands that have cliff sides that rise 200 feet from the waters vertically. It's almost impossible to land a boat there. You have whirlpools in the channels that could sink a boat. You've got shoals, shallow shoals on the far side that a boat can run aground on. You've got almost daily storms, like little twister storms that come up the channels between the islands. Anybody up on top of the island wouldn't even notice it, but those storms would be enough to sink a ship. So there are all kinds of natural protections there if somebody needed to fortify themselves.
But, you know, one of the questions I have, if you use the theory that these settlements were learning centers, post-devastation of the earth set up by the survivors, the disseminators of information, which is what a lot of people believe Göbekli Tepe was and some other areas. But, I mean, why have it so far north? And it is, you know, unless you do have a boat, you can't get to this island. Is there evidence on the mainland that leads to this area? Or is it, do you think it was like... they brought the initiatives with them and said, okay, you will be here for a period of time, and this is a learning center. Is that what it basically comes out to be?
Yeah, it looks like a college campus, and the Scarabray village looks like dorm housing. In the Dogon conception, there's a difficulty here. We have a match between two symbolic systems, the Dogon and the Buddhist, but they're given in completely different languages. One's in Sanskrit, the other one's using mostly ancient Egyptian words. So we know that one didn't automatically just take it wholesale from the other one. These are both ancient traditions that are documented back, you know, as far as 700 BC or so. It looks like both cultures managed to keep their symbolic systems, which are very complicated. They kept all those details straight down to modern times, and when you compare what a modern authority on Buddhism says to what a modern Dogen priest says about their tradition, you've got a match. Symbols mean the same things, and practices mean the same things, even though they're given in different words. Now, the problem is this, that the Buddhists flatly say that their most sacred symbols were given to humanity by a non-human source.
Right.
The Dogen say that it was given to them by a non-human source, but they go a step further. They say not only was it non-human, but originally it was non-material. And their teachers had a concern. The concern was the potential bad effects that being around the teachers would have on us. And so to limit that the potential bad effects, the solution they came up with was to sequester 8 tribespeople at a remote location, instruct those 8, and send them back to teach everybody else. Now, that pattern plays out all over the world. You've got the 8 mythical emperors in China who brought civilizing skills, and you've got everywhere you go in South America, Central America, pretty much any ancient culture, even in Egypt, you've got this tradition of 8 knowledgeable ancestors who are considered mythic in some ways and considered historical in other ways, but who are the bringers of the same set of civilizing skills. Now, it looks to me as if Scarabray could be the place where that happened. The Dogen said that their teachers needed to be in close proximity to water. They haven't explained precisely why. It looks to me like they needed to be in a certain proximity to water and a certain proximity to the electromagnetism of the poles, which would explain why you have sites that are located so far north. My perspective is that at 3200 BC, any person who's talking with authority about how matter forms, the least of their problems is getting around. Anybody who knows that, you know,
yeah.
If they understand how what the structure of matter is, they're not going to have a problem transporting themselves. So now you look at DNA studies of northern Scotland, and you discover that surprisingly, to everybody's surprise, northern Scotland is one of the most genetically diverse places in the entire world. They don't know why. From my perspective, if they were bringing groups of 8 initiates to this island, training them and send them back someplace, that explains a whole lot of things. It explains why carved structures in Egypt look like carved structures in South America. If they all received instruction from the same group of people in the same place. Now, the Dogon, or the Egyptians, refer to a first time. This is the era that they look fondly back on, nostalgically back on, when the gods were supposedly inhabiting side by side with humans. The Buddhists talk about a time when knowledge was first passed to humanity by a Buddha, and it happened at a place they call Vulture Peak. Now, Göbekli Tepe, one of the prominent carved images that you see on the pillars there is of vultures.
Right, yeah.
So you've got their perspectives that there was an instructional time, ancient times, at a remote site similar to what the Dogon have. The Hebrew scholars, if you think about the jealous God saying, thou shalt have no other gods before me, the Hebrew scholars discussed that and concluded that that statement implies that there were other gods. Well, I say the same thing. When the Egyptians talk about a first time and the Buddhists talk about a first time, that implies that there was more than one time. If there hadn't been more than one time, they would have just called it the time. So it makes sense to me that there had been an attempt at instruction around 10,000 B.C. We see things in Egypt that seem to date to 10,000 B.C. We've got a sphinx that supposedly aligns with the constellation Leo in 10,000 B.C., and we've got pyramids that Robert Bovall feels align with the belt stars of Orion at 10,000 B.C.
Right.
Now, if that's true, those alignments pretty much had to have been set in 10,000 B.C., because otherwise, we have to conclude that somebody in a later period had the math to be able to retrospectively calculate what their proper alignment should have been. So it looks like we have 10,000 BC era influences in the era of Göbekli Tepe at Egypt, maybe a first try at establishing agriculture. And my guess is that those didn't end up taking. They didn't take hold the way they should have. And so later on down the line now, another attempt is made at 3200 BC to do it. Who knows if there were intervening attempts that also failed. Hmm. But the one at 3200 BC absolutely succeeded. About 100 years later, at 3100 BC, you have agricultural kingships appearing in four regions of the planet. You have one in Egypt associated with the word taru. You have one in Ireland associated with the word aru, one in China called iru, and one in South America called peru. Those
fantastic.
those four terms also are Egyptian words that represent the four cardinal points of the planet. They represent sunrise and sunset, and lower and upper, which is north and south. And then on another level of interpretation, those four words represent four stages of an agricultural field: an unplanted field, planted field, field with plants growing in it, and then a granary is where the harvested grain goes.
Hmm.
So you have a system. You have evidence of a system here, and it looks to me as if all of those agricultural kingships that arise inexplicably at the same moment in history arise for a reason. They were related to the same instruction.
I find the comparison of the four, I call them reboot centers, agricultural centers around the world, quite interesting. If we were to use the theory that the survivors of a deluge were setting out to reboot, restart Earth humans, those survivors, and they used, let's just say they had some form of ships that were still around, and they self-propulsion of some kind and got around to these different places. Is there any symbolism in all those areas that you've discovered, or closer to what we're talking about, Skara Brae and Göbekli Tepe, or perhaps pre-dynastic Egypt that are similar that we've found?
I think that both perspectives can be true. I mean, the Dogon, I was talking about the Egyptians talking about a first time. Mm-hmm. Where they talk about a first time and the Buddhists talk about a first time, the Dogon are talking about a time when humanity was restored to culture, which implies that there had been high culture before, at some era before that. Göbekli Tepe happens right at the end of the Ice Age. The Ice Age sort of serves as a gigantic block to evidence. We don't really know what happened before that in a lot of cases.
Right.
It's hard to trace it. So I think it's quite possible, if not quite likely, that there was high culture in the form of what we think of as Atlantis, whether it was Atlantis or not. The Faroese language makes it look like it was because the phrase makes sense. And it reconciles that sense to the Egyptian language, that the idea of an ancestral country plays a part in this. The problem is that when we get to the bottom of all these cultures that I'm studying, what they're saying is not, oh yes, we learned this from the survivors of a previous culture. They're saying we learned this from somebody who understood the science and who was not human. And so it's trying to reconcile.
Well, let me stop you there. Let me just stop you real quick. Why do you say they're not human? Just because they're dealing with concepts that are from the cosmos, physics that we don't understand, or why do you say they're non-human?
Okay, here's the reason why we have to consider the possibility of non-humans. It looks like the Buddhists kept their complex system of symbols straight for thousands and thousands of years.
Mm-hmm.
In parallel, in a different language, the Dogon kept their system straight for thousands and thousands of years. They match today. Now, the problem is they're both saying they got it from a non-human source. So as a researcher, I can take the stance that, well, yes, they managed to keep all the other details straight, but inexplicably they both misremembered who they got it from and accidentally remembered it in matching ways to each other. They both came out of it forgetting who they actually got it from, but saying they got it from a non-human source. Or I can say they kept all of those other details straight, and they kept the memory of who they got it from straight, in which case, as a researcher, I have to entertain the possibility of non-human source. Because they're flatly saying it. The way my studies work, my interpretations have to begin with statements on their part. It's not Laird Scranton who says the Dogon system represents how matter forms. It's the Dogon priests who say it. My job is to take their statement and try to test it to see that is there a perspective from which their statement makes sense.
Okay.
Well, the further I get into the science aspect of it, it's side by side comparability with modern science. It's making a correct statement. This is how matter forms. Now, having this correctly described how matter forms from atom all the way down to waves establishes a certain amount of credibility for them. Here's a whole range of things that we're able to test and verify that they've got this right.
Mm-hmm.
Now they start telling us things that we're not in a position to test, like they got it from a non-human source. As a researcher, do I discount the fact that they've established credibility for that they know what they're talking about and just toss that out the window? Or do I say, because they've established credibility for themselves, I must consider that it might have been non-human?
Okay, Hang on a second. Let me just cut into this real quickly. So this is what my understanding is of when you say God, and now you're saying non-human. If we are visited by a extremely scientifically advanced individual who can, through his technology or his applications of physics or whatever, can do things we consider miraculous, that is considered a god. And if a civilization is very remote and very at its early stages of development, that kind of an individual would be considered a god. Now, you're saying the Dogon say they're non-human. How can you define non-human and human? That's the question I have, because I find this fascinating when I hear this kind of thing.
Okay, now, first of all, the Dogon had the presence of mind to ask their teachers if they were God. Now, you know from reading sci-fi books and seeing sci-fi movies, you know, the first rule of sci-fi is if somebody asks you if you're God, you say, oh, yes, I am God. You know, that keeps the natives at bay if they think you're God. I mean, the Spanish did it in South America. The Dogon teacher said, no, we're not God. If it helps you to think of us as agents of God, that's fine with us. So
that's confusing.
That is confusing. Now, the idea that something that's non-material, the Dogon are saying this began as a non-material entity that was able to act in the material domain, which seems like a ludicrous statement until you stop and you think that if you've heard of the three-slit experiment that scientists do, where they contest that by observing matter in this wave-like state, they transform it into particles, into particle-like behavior.
Okay.
In the wave-like state, this is essentially massless. This is non-material stuff. We don't consider the waves to be a material structure. As soon as we perceive it, it's transformed into something that we do consider to be material, a particle. So we already know that everything that we consider to be material has transformed from behavior that was originally non-material-like. That's already an established perspective.
Hmm.
So the idea that somehow under some kind of circumstances that we might not fully understand yet, it's possible in the mindset of these traditions, universes form in pairs. If you go back to the archaic philosophies that underlie these traditions that I've been studying, the perspective is that universes form in pairs, and that one is non-material and the other one is material. That matter happens when energy from the non-material universe comes in contact with energy from the material universe in the context of an act of perception by us, and that transforms it the same way that turning on your computer screen transforms the Wi-Fi signal into an image.
Okay, so what you're basically saying is that the Dogon believe that their teachers were non-physical and that they were some kind of intelligence in some form that could communicate with them.
Yes, the Dogon name for their teachers is the Pneumo. The word Nu means waves, and Ma means perceived. Nu Ma is an Egyptian phrase. So the teachers themselves are named in accordance with the outlook that says that they began as waves and now they were able to perceive them finally. In the Buddhist perspective, there's a yuga cycle that happens. And during the course of that yuga cycle, humanity goes through, periodically goes through phases where we are more and less able to perceive things that are non-material. We're just now on the ascending path up from the bottom of the cycle where we were the least spiritually or non-materially aware that we are, that we get in this cycle. It's sort of like at the bottom of winter, if you think of it as a year, if they call it the great year. Well, we're now a month or so into coming out of winter in terms of the yuga cycle. So now if you imagine that our perceptions of the non-material change over time, then there might theoretically be a point in there where it was possible for a crossover between non-material and material.
That's fascinating. I've never heard the yugas described in such a way. I mean, they're so in depth. They're so enriched with layers of consciousness and lifetimes and civilizations. It's just to be able to communicate readily and comfortably in a time period is fascinating. I think we do this now when we meditate and we have a real lucid meditation. We can contact different consciousnesses, but you have to be aware of that and not think, oh, it's my own consciousness talking to me. It's, you know, so it's a whole different level. So
yeah, that's part of the archaic philosophy also, is that the non-material side has perfect knowledge but an inability to act. And the material side has imperfect knowledge with full ability to act. And in the mindset of this philosophy, routine attempts are made to communicate from the non-material side to the material side. I compare it to like a game of charades, where a subtle action is taken on the non-material side to try to induce a particular action or response on the material side. And in the mindset of that philosophy, that can happen through vivid dreams, through what look like coincidences. It can happen through meditation. It can happen through divination, through clairvoyance, a number of different methods by which, but as you say, you have to, first of all, allow the possibility that there's something going on other than just coincidence, and sort of train yourself to recognize the difference. And there are ways of recognizing the difference. What it took to convince me was, anyone who begins to study these subjects has stories of odd things that have happened over their period of study. For me, sometimes they're very tangible events and sometimes they're very intangible, but it took me a while to recognize they were actually happening. I'm lucky that it began with a very tangible one. I was, early in my process, I was looking for a book called Ancient Near Eastern Texts Relating to the Old Testament. And this is before you could go online and search for an out-of-print book. And I had exhausted all the local sources to find the book, new bookstores and used bookstores. Nobody could order it for me. I had even gone to Vassar College, where I went to college, and tried to get their interlibrary loan service to come up with a copy for me, and they couldn't. And so finally I had to resign myself to the fact I wasn't going to find the book. Well, a few days later, a box turns up on my back doorstep. My wife, Risa, had an aging cousin living down in Queens in a small apartment, and every so often he'd hit critical mass of stuff in his apartment, and he'd pack up a bunch of random stuff in a box and mail it off to a relative. And
he sounds like
box,
an eccentric fellow, quite an eccentric.
In and among the random stuff, you know, the hot mitts and the flags of the world and all sorts of odd random stuff, there was my book. And he had no idea I was looking for it. He couldn't even remember having owned the book when we asked him about it after the fact.
Jesus.
And that kind of thing, from as tangible an event as that to really subtle, intangible ones, have been the rule as I study these things. To give you an example, there's a book I wrote called Point of Origin. And that book was a direct result of one summer day when I thought I was researching half a dozen different questions for friends about language. One morning, I discovered the answer to all half a dozen questions in the same half-hour period, and they all related to words in a single column of a single page of the Egyptian Hieroglyphic Dictionary. And the seventh word on the page was the word that opened up the Point of Origin book for me.
Fantastic. That's total synchronicity. There's something about synchronistic things like that. It's just, you can't, you know, how does that happen? It's like, you know, if you're into the angels, your angel is helping you. Or, you know, the vibrations, you're in sync with the vibrations of your thought. And so what you want is manifesting on this level because, you know what I mean? It's just really hard to explain. But I think those kinds of synchronistic events are fascinating.
Yeah, I think they are too. And the trick is, at what point do you suspend disbelief about it? I was taught by my science teachers that if you're researching a question and you bump up against the third compounding coincidence, that it's time to consider that there might be something else going on besides coincidence.
Hmm.
Now, a lot of the people that I know who discuss these topics seem to have endless tolerance for coincidence. You know, that I can lay out a 25-point Dogen structure of matter, and they say, oh, it's just coincidence. You can't have 25 coincidences in a row that all relate to each other. You can't have a progression like that, that after you get past the third or the fourth one, you have to start to accept the fact that it looks like something's going on here.
Hmm. Definitely. these ancient structures tip us and turn on deep recesses of our consciousness when we look at them. And the real fun thing about your work, Laird, is that you write what your perception of the book is, but you also give the reader an opportunity to expand on what their level of consciousness is and what they think about these things. And what is the importance of this place? Well, could be an educational center. This could represent a period of time where we needed to have our civilization rebooted, is what the general thinking is right now. But maybe it wasn't that. Maybe it was just a period in time where we needed to have to learn about our cosmos, to learn about our the surrounding universe. And that's what I want to talk about our next question here, which is, have they found anything other than the position of these megaliths to be calendars? Is there anything else that makes them, the megaliths, unique in as a tool for, I don't know, commuting with the higher levels or gaining additional information?
Well, they represent information in the same way that an alphabet does. I mean, if I want to demonstrate that a four-year-old knows their alphabet, what it takes is they need to be able to recite it to me while either pointing to the correct letter or drawing the correct letter. Mm-hmm. And if they can do that, any person is going to agree that child knows the alphabet. There's no question. Well, on Orkney Island, what they've done is they've recited the stages of matter in the correct sequence. They've named the sites. They've given names to the sites that go along with the proper stage of matter that it's supposed to represent. It really is sort of a geometric progression. So it begins with what's called a watchstone, a single stone that represents a point. And there are traditions on Orkney Island that there used to be a second one of these watchstones, which would create the concept of a line. And then that progresses to a stone circle. Stone circles, in the traditions I study, one of the key purposes of a stone circle is to be able to identify, to mark out seasons of the year, to know when to plant crops and when to harvest crops. And it gives visibility. A stone circle, first of all, gives visibility to the hours of a day because it begins with a sundial. If you have a stone in the middle,
right.
Basically you've got a sundial. Okay, now placing these stones east and west from each other, you define lines, and as the sun rises and sets and the shadows hit two stones that are in line with each other, you can sort of watch this line of the seasons move further northward until it hits the solstice, and then back to the equinox, and further southward until it hits the solstice, and back again. It gives visibility with shadows to when the seasons are happening.
Fascinating.
So then from there you move on to what symbolically is the shape of a hemisphere. On Orkney Island, it's the Maze Howe chambered cairn that was originally had a hemispheric shape to it. And then that leads on to the chambered houses at Scarabray. But what's even more interesting is that the structure, I know that cosmologically speaking, that's only part way up the structure. That structure continues all the way up to the concept of electrons and atoms and things like that. The next phase beyond those eight chambers is represented by the Dogon using an agricultural field. It's trying to represent the concept of particles forming against what scientists call a background field. And so The Dogon, just before they begin planting every year, create a figure in a field, sort of akin to a crop circle. It's a circle with a bunch of zigzag lines in the middle of it that represent the vibrations of matter. And they create that in the agricultural field of their top priest, who's called the Eru priest. In Egypt, they've got a similar concept. Their word for field is Sekhet, and the term is Sekhet Eru. It goes with this field of the Eru priest. And Sekhet Eru referred to the concept of heaven, essentially, in Egypt. It's what eventually became the Elysian fields in Greece. Egyptians did, there are paintings on the walls of tombs that represent, and in papyruses, their pictures drawn, that represent what this Sekhet Eru, or concept of heaven, the field of reeds, was supposed to look like. And they're depicting animals that are all indigenous to Orkney Island. You get down to the Greek times, and they're describing how you get to it, and the geographic descriptions they're getting point to where Orkney Island is. They talk about geographic attributes and weather attributes and things like that that are all right for Orkney Island. They even call it Okeanos. So it looks as if this concept that the Dogon deal with on two levels, it's a myth, but it's also a real geographic place. It looks like for the Egyptians it was a myth, but it was also a real geographic place. Same thing for the Greeks. And Orkney Island, from my perspective, could have been that geographic place.
Interesting.
The Egyptians associate it with the West, and modern researchers have sort of minimized that they take references to the West, even though it's talking about where the sun sets. They minimize it. They bring it back to the hills and the mountains on the west side of the west bank of the Nile River. But the Greek perspective is it's alongside the edge of the Western Ocean. They're talking about where Orkney Island is. Now, we know with Schliemann, he took mythical references that looked like real geography, and it led him right to where historical Troy was. The Greek writers give us geographic details that seem to lead us right to where Orkney Island is. The Greek writers also talk about Atlantis, and they give us geographic details that, based on the history of these other situations, my best guess is their geography about Atlantis is, if I had to guess, I would say it was correct. They haven't misled us on the other geography. Why would they mislead us on that?
Let me stop you there. Where do you believe Atlantis was? In the Atlantic, the down closer to the Caribbeans, or where? Or just the huge island that
That's an open question. There's some evidence. Okay, now if it were located where they said it was, across from the pillar,
Pillars of Hercules,
Gibraltar, basically.
Yeah.
And if it had sunk there, well, there are ocean currents that would have taken them right to where Orkney Island and the Faroe Islands are. It's a natural place for a survivor to go. And the names ancestral country are given from the perspective of somebody who had to leave that country and has a fondness for their homeland. It's like, you know, immigrants to the U.S. will talk about the old country. So there's a perspective that says, yeah, the mindset of there having been in Atlantis where the Greeks say it was works. There's another perspective that could also work. There's evidence to suggest that maybe the Faroe Islands themselves were the original Atlantis. Maybe what we're seeing there with concentric sort of parallel islands, a series of parallel islands next to each other, are the remnants of what was originally concentric circles that were described for Atlantis. To me, it's an open question as to, I know that every researcher and his brother has found a locale and found a rationale to explain why Atlantis was located where they think, even when it doesn't line up with anything. But what I can say is it looks to me like there were, there's no reason not to think that there weren't high culture before the Ice Age.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever you want to call that, there were going to be some survivors of whatever that culture were. And we see that in references, Native American references and South American Indian references and things like that.
Well, let me ask you, while we're on that subject, to me, to some people, high culture means intellectualism, you know, books and learning, kind of where you sat around Socrates and you expounded philosophy and things like that, and you wrote, you know, and you had medicine, things like that. And then there's another level, which is the technological level, which I see in sophisticated engineering and building construction. I see it in Central America with the Maya, and I personally believe that the Maya had a good percentage of their culture handed down to them. But when you say sophisticated, what are you saying? Are you saying flying ships, which I also believe were around prior to the start of the Mayan civilization. But I'm just curious, what is your conception of that?
Well, again, because we don't have evidence, it's hard to anchor it. But if you think that in a period span of 5,000 years, we've gone from what we know they had in ancient Egypt to what we have now in terms of technology, and we're on the verge of being able to go off the planet to other planets. Okay. If we can do that in 5,000 years, there's no good reason in the hundreds of thousands of years of history of humanity before that it couldn't have happened in the same amount of time or less.
Yeah.
So it's sort of nonsense to say that over the course of 200,000 years nothing happened and then suddenly it did.
Mm-hmm. But
it's
all children by the time
they're five are the same. My mother-in-law used to say, all children, by the time they're five and they enter kindergarten, they're all pretty much equal. I imagine that civilizations are the same way. By the time they reach 5,000 years old, there's not much stopping them from having discovered everything that they are going to discover.
Everything that's on their to-do list, almost. But the thing is, we do have evidence of extremely sophisticated technology. We have these perfectly engineered cut stones that make up the Great Pyramid. We have evidence of stonework in Baalbek, Lebanon, of megaliths in the thousands of tons that were perfectly cut and positioned to create the temple. We have evidence in Peru of extremely high precision cutting of stonework.
Drilling.
Yeah, and drilling too. I mean, this is, and I can give examples in most considered older to ancient parts of the world. So, and this is what is tough on me is people say, well, where is the evidence of the machines? You know, where are the machines that cut us? Well, the results of the machines are something to look at. And I think that is a great deal of evidence, don't you think?
Well, right. And also if you consider that 5,000 years from now, you won't be able to tell there were skyscrapers in New York. If it wasn't built from stone, it won't survive.
Yeah.
And so there might have been all sorts of things that were made out of metal, but we would have no evidence of those. There's a book by a friend of mine named Michael Cremo. It's called Forbidden Archaeology. It's like a 700-page book.
Yeah,
just crammed full of all of the archaeological finds that didn't fit the paradigm that sort of got shoved aside.
Mm-hmm.
So part of our problem is that we have a scientific mindset that's not being wholly honest about what's been discovered.
Well, it just shakes the tree too much. It's too hard for them to say, well, here's evidence of some kind of laser or cutting device that cut the hardest granite we know, like butter, and we have evidence of this in Egypt at the various quarries. So we're not going to accept that as you know, we'd rather have the granite ball cutting a obelisk, which I find hilarious.
Yes. One of my books is about Emanuel Velikovsky, and it was talking about damage that was seen in the crust of Mars. And there was a study done by Caltech that said that you can explain the damage by a single impact from a planet-sized body that happened millions, you know, 25 million years ago or more.
Mm-hmm.
So I tracked down one of the researchers, and I said, can you explain to me why it has to be that many million years ago? I mean, what is it that argues that it had to happen then? And they said, well, everybody knows there haven't been bodies roaming the solar system since that time that could have done it. And so Velikovsky's perspective is that there were. And so you have sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy where a statement is made as if it were fact. We have the same thing happening with Egyptian calendars. It's stated as fact that the Egyptian had a 365-day calendar in ancient times. But that's not really the truth. What they know is they had a solar calendar. They don't know for sure how many days it was. And so there's potential that the length of the year has changed over time.
Fascinating. Hey, in the book, in this mystery of Skara Brae, you write that the god El may have been celebrated at the location, which is in Hebrew, Yahweh. Why is that important?
Well, El is actually a counterpart in Hebraic traditions to Yah. El is a sort of space to Yah's light. So they're a pair of gods that go together in the mindset of that cosmology. What's interesting is, starting at Göbekli Tepe, you have ancient Egyptian terms for that region where Göbekli Tepe is that seem to be expressed in terms of Pet, which is Ptah in Egypt, Ka, which is a god in Egypt, and Yah, which is a Hebrew god. You have an intermix of god names that cross cultures. You've got another ancient sanctuary name in Egypt that includes words that are arguably the names of gods in the Indian tradition, India, not of, you know, like the Vedic tradition and later Hindu traditions. So you have this intermix of god names. The farther back in time you go, the more it's sort of tossed up in the air as to which reference you're going to get. The traditions I study, there's a naming convention for the tribes who learned about them. They named themselves. It's almost as if you or I were going to college, we declare a major. We're going to major in engineering, or we're going to major in home economics, or whatever we're going to major in. Well, each of these tribes that were instructed when they went out into the world adopted a name that expresses what their major was. In Judaism, it was Yahuda. It says, praises Yah, is what those Yah and Huda mean. For the pre-dynastic tribes, it was Amazighi, which is combines the name Ama, which is a creator god, with an Egyptian word Sakai that means to celebrate. You've got it all over the world. You've got it down into Polynesia with the Maori, culture after culture after culture. If you know what the ancient name for the tribe was, you can explain what their religious perspective was, or their cosmological perspective was, on what they were focusing, what concept they focused on. So El is one of those names, and Ske El, which is the name of the bay that Skara Brae sits on, says, to me, celebrates El, and El is the name of a deity. There are other references to El throughout that region of the world that that are similar. But so that says that that piece of the mindset, there are a lot of things that come into the traditional phrasing of modern religion that come out of the Faroese language or are aligned with the Faroese language, like the word for, in the Faroese language, for the lowest part of something is Hades, essentially. The name that eventually gets assigned to heaven in the Faroese language refers to a safe haven. It's Haven. There's a name that refers to God. God in these philosophies is conceptualized as a kind of a gateway between the non-material and material, and the Faroese word is Gat. The Dogon word is Gat, and the Egyptian word is Gat. So a large part of what happens in the Scarab Ray book is the aligning of these words to each other. A linguist will tell you that simply because two words are pronounced alike and have the same meaning doesn't mean they're related to each other. There's too much chance of coincidence. There aren't enough phonetic values in a language to guarantee you're not going to get coincidental things like that. But what I try to do, what the cosmology allows us to do, is to bring, you know, multiple points of evidence to bear on that word and what it relates to, and demonstrate that both words are have a cluster of meanings that associate with them that mean they have to match.
Is there any evidence of any of the teachers or people who may have been the people who put together Scarab Ray in terms of this was the main person, this was the leader, this was the one of these survivors of the great catastrophe?
Well, the Dogon don't anthropomorphize deities the same way other cultures do. In Dogon culture, pretty much everything is represented as stages or concepts of creation. And when you walk those across into the Egyptian culture, suddenly what was a concept for the Dogon becomes a god for the Egyptians. There are commonalities in the way the symbolism works. You can tie it together based on names and so forth. So the Dogon aren't really, beyond telling us titles of their teachers, like referring to them generically as Numo, we're not getting individual names of teachers that we can tie back to a deity. That's just not in their mindset. They also didn't make graven images of their gods. That's something that in the traditions I'm following didn't happen until much later. The early philosophical traditions that underlie this didn't do that. They would use symbolism from real-world symbolism. They'd use an animal to represent something, or they'd use a shape of a tree or something you could see in your environment. But they wouldn't anthropomorphize, really. Now, in terms of trying to tie the traditions together, there's lots and lots of words that they mostly come out of place names and out of concepts that are shared, not out of names of deities. Scael is a reference to a deity. We know that these ancient Egyptian names for sanctuaries, I can see, are formulated on the traditional form of one of these ancient words. It's based on the names of three deities who are related to each other, or on three astronomic bodies who relate to those deities. So I guess the easy answer is to say, no, I don't really see evidence of specific gods, because that's not the way the tradition worked at 3200 BC.
Okay. And the last question, which I think is not going to be greatly easy to answer, but I think you can probably give us an overview. What do you want the reader to get from this book? This is an important place, and I don't think enough people know about it. And I think there's going to be more of these kinds of places that are discovered as we begin to find them and understand that they're similar to Göbekli Tepe, which so far, just because of its the remains and the symbolism and the writing and the animals that are on supports and things. It is a significant learning center. This appears to be a learning center. But what is it the important aspect of your book? What's the takeaway?
For me, this is a significant site historically because of its timing and geographically because you can trace all sorts of other cultures from this spot. There's a follow-on book to this that's about the Maori in New Zealand that they have references back to many of the things I talk about in this book. A lot of the things that are going on in the lower UK relate back to this, only there's no foundation for why they relate back to this. I'm in the enviable position of being sort of the first guy to have an opinion, a theory about what was going on at Orkney Island and Scarabray. To me, it looks like this was the significant predecessor to everything that we see beginning historically 100 years afterwards. And all of those things, like we don't have an official perspective on where the pharaohs came from. We don't have an official perspective on where the Chinese emperors came from. So again, this is a potential way to link all of those things together with one piece falls into place and the puzzle sort of pulls together.
Fantastic.
To me, that's the significant piece of it is this is a pivot point. This is where things turn from.
Okay, perfect. The book is The Mystery of Scarabray, Neolithic Scotland, and the Origins of Ancient Egypt. And my guest has been Laird Scranton. It's been a pleasure. This is a fun book to read, and he's got some great illustrations in here, too, and photographs. Thank you, Laird. I appreciate your time.
Thanks very much, Cliff. I appreciate you having me on.
Okay, that was fun. I hope you enjoyed that. Laird is, if there's anyone who's an academic in this field, it's him. He's quite prolific in his writing. Next week, quite an interesting show. This book I got, and I'm still flabbergasted by it. It's the Sagan Conspiracy, NASA's untold plot to suppress the people scientists' theory of ancient aliens. This is going to be a mind blower. This is the story of Carl Sagan, who wrote a special paper that was suppressed by NASA. And basically, he believed that Earth had been visited by ancient aliens, which is completely a little off the wall, simply because he was very anti-Von Doniggin, anti-ancient aliens, and right up to his death, believed it was, something that could not be considered. In fact, he supported the whole SETI program, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, that was started by Frank Drake in the late 1960s. So next week, the Sagan Conspiracy with the author of the book. All right, I hope you'll enjoy it, your day, and I will talk to you again.
To Old Navy right now for the year's biggest denim deal. 2 days only, all jeans are 50% off. That's right, today and tomorrow, all jeans are 50% off at Old Navy and oldnavy.com. But you'd better hurry, it ends tomorrow. Valid 224 and 225, excludes clearance.